many years, I was a regular reader of the Reader's Digest magazine. And I remember one cartoon in one of the issues of Reader's Digest magazine. It may be 30 years old. So that cartoon was of a picture of a minister, a religious minister, about to give a religious talk to the congregation. And the picture shows him from the back. And under the, what do you call this, podium, under the microphone stand, there was a bag of golf clubs. And the caption says, "Today I will be brief." So, following that cartoon, I think I will be brief today. But I'm not going to play golf. I was searching for a subject to talk about tonight, and I did not know what to talk about. But fortunately, I got some topic from the interviews with the yogis. So some yogis asked me some questions, and one yogi even asked me to give the answer to her question when I give a Dhamma talk. So today's talk will not be on one subject only, but some questions the yogis asked me to explain. The first thing I want to talk about is about equanimity. Now, a yogi wants to know what equanimity is. Equanimity, as used in Buddhist books, is a neutrality of mind. Neutrality means not falling to the either side, so to stay in the middle and not to fall to either side, and that is called equanimity in the Buddhist teachings. And in the teachings of the Buddha, equanimity is a mental state. It is, many of you know, one of the 52 mental factors taught in Abhidhamma. And this is called specific neutrality. So specific neutrality is a name for equanimity consisting in the equal balance of the associated states. Now, the mental states arise together. Now, there are two mental states, consciousness and mental factors. So consciousness and mental factors always arise together. So when they arise together, and they do their respective functions. So for them to do their respective functions properly, there is one mental state called specific neutrality. So this keeps the associated states or cognizant mental states in equal balance. This specific neutrality take many forms. Now, when this specific neutrality arises in the mind of an arahant, now it is called equanimity with six factors. Now, that means when an arahant, say, sees a visible object, he is neither glad nor sad about that object. So he is not moved by the quality of the object. So an arahant can dwell in equanimity and be mindful and fully aware of the object, but he will not be glad or sad, say, when he sees the object. So the same with the other kinds of objects. There are six kinds of objects, and that is why this equanimity is called equanimity with six factors. Actually, equanimity regarding six kinds of objects. So whenever an arahant sees or experiences any one of the six kinds of objects, he is able to keep his mind neutral, not liking, not disliking. So that kind of equanimity is called equanimity with six factors. When the equanimity or neutrality is practiced towards beings, then it is called a divine abiding or Brahma Vihara. So, you know, there are four kinds of Brahma Viharas: loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. Equanimity is neutrality towards all beings. That means when a person practices equanimity as a divine abiding, even when he sees a being in suffering, he will not feel compassion. Even if he sees a person in prosperity, he will not feel happiness. So whether he sees a person in distress or in prosperity, his mind is always neutral. So that kind of neutrality is one equanimity, one form equanimity takes. And equanimity can take a form of factor of enlightenment. So equanimity is one of the seven factors of enlightenment. So there, equanimity means, again, neutrality among the cognizant or associated states. That means when the equanimity is developed to the level of enlightenment factor, again, this mental state can keep other factors of enlightenment in proper balance and letting them do their own respective functions. And when this arises in a yogi does not have to make effort, say, to be mindful or to watch objects. So it is effortless awareness of the objects when this equanimity is developed to the enlightenment factor. And when it arises with jhana, it is called equanimity of jhana. Now, you know, there are different stages of jhana. The first jhana, second jhana, and so on. in the fourth jhana, this factor is so developed that even in the bliss, even in the highest bliss of jhana, it is impartial. That means the equanimity is not partial to the bliss attained through jhanas. So the bliss attained through jhanas are said to be very refined and sublime. But even in such bliss, a yogi is impartial. Even among these highest bliss, he is impartial. He will not like or dislike that kind of bliss, or he will not be interested in that kind of bliss. So he tries to transcend bliss and enjoy what is called equanimity. And it is said that this equanimity is on a higher level than what we call sukha or bliss. And when equanimity arises with the highest jhana, it is called equanimity regarding purifying. That means the highest jhana is the most purified of all jhanas. And when a yogi has reached the highest, the most purified jhana, he has no interest in purifying it because it is already purified. So the equanimity arising together with that highest jhana is called equanimity about purifying. That means he is indifferent in purifying because it is already purified. So equanimity is neutrality, impartiality, and being unmoved by the objects, either desirable or undesirable. So just one equanimity is called six-factored equanimity, equanimity as a divine abiding, and so on, depending on where it arises. So this equanimity or equanimity or neutrality yogis experience when their meditation is good, when they have a good concentration. Now, some people want to know whether this is Nibbana. Now, this is not Nibbana. Now, in order to understand this, you need to understand what Nibbana is. And it is very difficult to talk about Nibbana because it cannot be described in the terms we are used to. Because when we explain Nibbana, we use negative terms like cessation of dukkha, cessation of suffering, or extinction of greed, hatred, and delusion, and so on. Nibbana is, let us say, a state that can be taken as object, but it is not a subject. That means it does not take any object, but it is the object which is taken by the other states, other mental states. And it It is said that Nibbana is not made, not created, and unborn, and not conditioned. That is why it is difficult to understand and difficult to describe. So what is not conditioned has no beginning. Only when something is made or something is conditioned, it has a beginning. But since Nibbana is not made, not conditioned, it has no beginning. That is why it has no end. If it has beginning, it must have an end. Now, since it has no beginning, it has no end. And how can we perceive or think of something that has no beginning and no end, and still it is something that can be taken as object? So it is very difficult. So in Abhidhamma, Nibbana is classified as an external object. So Nibbana cannot be in the minds of beings. It is an external object that can be taken as object by some types of consciousness. And it is also said that Nibbana is not a mental state. Nibbana is not matter. So no mental state, no matter, no earth element, and so on. So it is a state of peacefulness, or it is the extinction of mental defilement, or extinction of five aggregates, or extinction of suffering. As the extinction of suffering, it is a separate object that is taken as object by the path consciousness and fruition consciousness. When using English, we can say Nibbana is not a mental state. But if we use Pali, it is different. So I don't want you to be confused, but I must say this. Now, the word for mind in Pali is Nama. N-A-M-A. And that Nama is defined as something that inclines towards the object. That is one definition. And the other definition is something that makes others to incline towards it. So the first definition is, say, ordinary definition, and the second definition is involves causative sense. So the first definition is something that inclines towards the object. That means that takes the object. And the second definition is something that makes others incline towards it. So there are two definitions of the word nama in Pali. Now, there are consciousness, mental states, material properties of matter, and Nibbana. Now, consciousness can take objects. That means consciousness inclines towards the object, and so consciousness is a nama. And mental factors always arise with consciousness, and so along with consciousness, they take object. So mental factors are also called nama. And consciousness, one consciousness can be the object of another consciousness. That means consciousness can make another consciousness incline towards it. So, by both definitions, consciousness is a nama. By both definitions, the mental factors are nama. Now we come to matter. We can take matter as object. So that means our mind inclines towards the object. But matter cannot take an object itself. So matter is no nama. It does not take an object, but Nibbana is called nama because it can make the consciousness inclined towards it. That means it can be taken as object by consciousness and mental factors. So, if we use English, we say Nibbana is not a mental state, so it's plain. But if we use Pali, we say Nibbana is also a nama, but it is not the same nama as the consciousness and mental factors. So consciousness and mental factors are called nama according to both definitions. But Nibbana is called nama according to the second definition only. So Nibbana is included in nama. But since Nibbana is included in nama, we cannot say that Nibbana is mental. So we should be careful about this. We should better not talk about Nibbana as nama at all. Now there is a saying in one discourse that we can find all four noble truths in this fathom long body. That means we can find all four noble truths in this body. And Nibbana is the third of the noble truth. But actually, we are not to understand that Nibbana is in us. Nibbana is in our mind or in our body. But it is said that Nibbana can be found in this body because Nibbana can be taken as object by our mind when we get enlightenment. So, since it can be taken as object by the mind which is internal to us, Buddha said that all these four noble truths can be found in this body. So, pointing out to that discourse, we are not to say that Nibbana can be in us. Nibbana is internal. Because Abhidhamma is very exact and strict, and in Abhidhamma it is classified as an external object. Although Nibbana is mostly defined in negative terms, it is not a negative state. It is a positive state. Because it is a positive state, it can be taken as object by path consciousness and fruition consciousness. So we can compare Nibbana to health. Now, what is health? No disease. So, absence of disease is what we call health. But it is not just the absence of disease, it is something positive, although we cannot describe, say, what health is. But we know and we experience health. So when we are healthy, we know that we have health, and when we have diseases, we know that we have no health. So health is a positive state. But if we are asked to explain what health is, we may just say it is absence of diseases. So in the same way, Nibbana is a positive state, And then we say Nirvana is the extinction of suffering and so on. Now the other question is about chetana of volition. Now chetana of volition is also a mental state. It is a mental state that organizes the other mental concomitants, or that pushes or that urges the other mental concomitants to do their respective functions. And this chetana, although it is a mental state and it disappears immediately after it arises, it has the potential to give results in the future. So when it disappears, it leaves some kind of potential to give results in the continuity of a being. We do not know where this potential is stored. But when the conditions are met with, when the conditions are favorable, then the results are produced. So that chetana, that translated in English as volition, is the one that produces results. And that chetana is what we call karma. So the word karma etymologically means a work, doing, or a deed. But actually, technically, karma is this chetana. But whenever you do something, this chetana always arises. So this chetana is always connected with deeds or works, and so the deeds come to be called karma. So nowadays, if you ask what is karma, you may say karma is a good or bad deed. But technically, karma is not good or bad deed, but the chetana of volition that arises in the mind when one does a good or bad deed. And that chetana has, as I said, the potential to give results in the future. It is taught in Abhidhamma that chetana accompanies every type of consciousness. But not chetana concomitant with every type of consciousness is called karma. Chetana that accompanies only the wholesome type of consciousness and unwholesome type of consciousness is called karma. Chetana can arise with the resultant consciousness. Chetana can arise with, say, what are called functional consciousness. So when chetana arises with resultant consciousness, when it arises with functional consciousness, it is not called karma because it has no power to produce results. Only when it accompanies the wholesome consciousness or unwholesome consciousness is it called karma. Only then can it produce results. And the results that arise are produced by chetana, the mental state, and not by the things, say, in a act of giving, and this is not the things that are offered that produce results. For example, you offer a set of rope to the Sangha, and according to the law of karma, you acquire kusala, wholesome karma, when you offer a set of ropes to the Sangha. And the chetana accompanying your consciousness is karma. And it is this chetana that produces results in the future and not the things you offer. A set of rope cannot produce anything. It is the product. But what produces results is not the thing, say, you offer, but the mental state that accompanies your consciousness when you make that offering. So chetana is described as a mental state that wills or that encourages other mental states to do their respective functions. Now, people want to know, if chetana encourages others, who encourages chetana? Now, chetana is compared to a chief pupil in the class. The chief pupil does his own work, and at the same time, he makes the other students work. So chetana encourages itself and it encourages other mental states. And another question is, how consciousness arises in the next life? Now you all know that karma produces results. At the beginning of one life, especially of, let us say, human beings, at the beginning of life as a human being, there is produced a type of consciousness, or there arises a type of consciousness which is produced by the karma in the past. According to the teachings of Abhidhamma, consciousness needs a physical base to arise, especially for human beings and other beings like animals. So if there is no physical base, consciousness cannot arise in these beings. So at the moment of, at the first moment in the life of a human being, as I said, there is produced a type of consciousness. But along with that type of consciousness, some material properties are also produced. So the arising of some material properties and the arising of that particular consciousness is what we call rebirth. So rebirth consists of a type of consciousness and some material properties, both results of karma in the past. Since there are material properties in the first arising of matter in a new life, consciousness can arise, having the material properties as a base. And so the consciousness in the previous life ceases with death. So no consciousness or no material properties move into the new life. The new life is a new life, and the old life ends with death. And then there is a new life or arising of the consciousness and material properties as a result of karma that person did in the past. So we are not to say how can consciousness arise, why after death the senses have decayed. So the consciousness that arises in the new life depends on a new material base in that new life, and it has nothing to do with the sense organs in the past life. Now, a new life is a life that is newly produced. So, although, let us call new life second life, and then the past life first life. So, although the second life is a new life, it is not totally disconnected with the past life. It is the result of the karma in the past life. So as cause and effect, they are related. They have some kind of relationship. But nothing from the old life or nothing from the first life moves into the second life. Although nothing goes from one life to another, there is a kind of relation or connection between the first life and the second life, that is as cause and effect. So that is why the karma of this person gives results to this continuity only and not to another continuity. Otherwise there will be chaos in the law of karma. My karma giving results to you or your karma giving results to me. So that cannot happen. So and one thing important to note about death and rebirth is that rebirth is not the result of death. That is important. Many people wrote that, say, death brings about rebirth, or sometimes they may say that as a result of former life, there is a new life. Although death, rebirth immediately follows death, rebirth is not the result of death. Now, as you know, rebirth is the result of karma. Karma in the past, not the result of death. But immediately after death, there is rebirth. So we are never to say that rebirth is the result of death. But we can say that rebirth is conditioned by death in the sense that death disappears so that rebirth can arise. It is something like giving a place to another person. So I'm sitting in this place, and if I vacate this place, then another person can sit in its place. So I am the condition for another person. So in that sense, death is a condition for rebirth. But that does not mean that rebirth is caused by death, or rebirth is a product of death. So they are two different things. Death belongs to the old life, and rebirth belongs to the new life. So we must never say that rebirth is the result of death, or death brings about rebirth. It just vacates its place so that rebirth can take place. Rebirth means rebirth consciousness and material properties along with it. If you want to know more about the process of death and rebirth, you study Abhidhamma. Yeah. So only in Abhidhamma the process of death and rebirth are explained in detail. And only when you have the knowledge of Abhidhamma do you understand correctly. Otherwise you may misunderstand, or you may make mistakes. So if you want to know more about the process, then please study Abhidhamma. Okay, I thought I would be brief. that is why I told you about the cartoon, but now it is not brief. It is almost time. I mean, regular time. Now, one more, not story, but something about the elephants. In our countries, they use elephants to haul logs, right? So elephants are trained to push the logs, and they are trained to stop when they hear the siren, when they hear the bell. So it is said that elephants would stop as soon as they hear the bell, even if there are about only 6 inches of the log to push. They will not push it. They will stop dead at the sound of the siren or the bell. So today I will be like an elephant. Say saru, saru, saru.